everyone, and welcome back to the Real Life Theology Podcast, Faith and Unity. Now, today we feature Jason Ishmael, who is the lead pastor of the Antioch Christian Church in the Cedar Rapids, Iowa area. Now, Daniel McCoy and Jason talk about the Restoration Movement, some of its history, but they emphasize the conversation about unity and faith in our culture today. Now, this episode wraps up our series on the Restoration Movement. So if you haven't tuned into this series, I recommend you jumping back a couple episodes and you'll be able to see it there. But with no further ado, here's the episode.
All right, I am here with Jason Ishmael, lead pastor of Antioch Christian Church, noticeably the church with the highest per capita number of McCoys in it nationwide. And it's a church I get to play bass at, so I love that. So Jason Ishmael, I was looking at your bio earlier. You said that you were called to ministry at age 12. Were you like in the temple?
I was just very confused.
The religious leaders, or I mean,
yeah, I was just very confused. Manipulated, coerced.
Sure.
Yeah, man. So Catholic dad, Baptist mom. And, you know, I think that
not so right.
Yeah, right. We used to call it a match made in purgatory. And so we tried everything. My mom and dad are, you know, prototypical 90s church shoppers. You know, they're just trying just about everything that they could to find their spot. And they tried everything. I mean, bro, we tried a Messianic Jewish synagogue when I was 5. My last name is Ishmael. I don't know if you get special seats, if you're Ishmael at the Messianic Jewish synagogue or not. I've tried it. But hey, Abraham's our dad. Come on, like, let us in. So as a result, like, we bounced around a ton and, you know, primarily in the Catholic Church and deep Catholic roots on my dad's side. And I'm one of these, I don't know. I have really fond memories of growing up in the Catholic Church. Some of my favorite childhood moments were at parish picnics, and I don't have like this jaded sense of my experiences. And, you know, they were beneficial to me. And at the same time, there was still like this, there was still something, there was more that I wanted. I still remember. And we moved and changed schools when I was 12 and ended up in an Assemblies of God church and school. So like way outside anything that we would have ever experienced at that point. Like, I'd never seen anybody that excited about anything outside maybe like scoring a touchdown. And they looked really similar to me, actually. And I was like, wow, these people are like, they're very excited about Jesus, about the church, about worshiping, about whatever. But my encounter, my experience with them to really experience in such like a lot, like many Protestants in that side would say, hey, we got to have a relationship with Jesus and we got to get into the Word of God. And I just got totally captivated. And through learning from a guy like Pastor Mark Johnson at Calvary Temple in Springfield, Illinois, who's still there, actually phenomenal, like just a total life change. I had a teacher. Jan Brandenburg was her name. She was my 7th grade English teacher and my Bible teacher. A couple of buddies that I met, the Lord through them drew me into this vibrant community of faith that was obviously impacting lives and impacting its community. And it felt so strongly at 12. I was like, that's all I ever want to do my whole life. I want to be a part of this. I want this to be what I give myself to. And so, ton of fun. 12 years old, though. That was all I ever, so yeah, that's all I've ever wanted to do ever since then.
That's awesome. And you're doing it. You're having a lot of fun. Tell us about it.
Well, yeah, we're here in Eastern Iowa. This is a church that we turned 50 this year, and it is a church that through its living out the mission, it has been a church that's reached its neighborhood, it's reached its community. It began, I would say, you know, 15 years ago to really reach its region. And that's some things we talk about all the time. And it's indicative of lots of things that have happened, especially in areas like ours, where we have sort of a mix of a semi-urban context. I mean, there's like couple hundred thousand people in Greater Cedar Rapids, Iowa. But then there's all these rural communities dotted around. And so you get kind of this like regional aspect. It's not unusual for people to drive 30 or 45 minutes to go to church. And that's because they drive 30 or 45 minutes to go to work. But they might be traveling like 30 or 40 miles to do that. Very different than a suburban context. And, you know, if you're in Chicagoland or something, or if you're, you know, in a big city and there's like, there's such density, there's lots of untapped opportunity and potential in these areas. And so we're seeing a church that's got a great launch pad, that's in a, you know, a suburb of 50,000 people, that's got a heart though for that town that's half an hour away, that's got 5,000 people in it. And in some of these towns, literally no thriving churches. So that's happening. We got a heart for that. I know that's like, and from the church planning context, it's like the rural stuff doesn't get everybody like, ooh, look at how cool these guys are. Like it's a thing that gets forgotten because it's easy to forget. It's not a lot of people. There's a reason they call this a flyover state. And so we feel God call us here because there's work to be done, and the gospel's thriving. People are hungry and surrendering to Jesus all the time. And it's, there's so much momentum in the mission, and more people every single week are putting their shoulder into it.
That's awesome. We're going to talk about the restoration movement kind of from your perspective as a lead pastor, but first kind of what was your master's degree in? Kind of how did that, you know, those studies kind of shape you?
Yeah, I did church history and historical theology with Dr. Bob Ray at Lincoln Christian University. Man, am I glad that guy's on our team. Just a brilliant man, so passionate for the church, for the gospel. And I remember discerning whether or not I wanted to pursue it. It wasn't necessarily something that was going to be like in what I do. Nobody cares that I have a graduate degree. It really doesn't matter. It doesn't buy me equity with them. And I'm grateful for that because it's like, who cares in all reality? Because it's not like I'm a professor or something. There's no prerequisites for that at our church that require master's degrees. I remember looking at Dr. Bob Ray before I started the program, and I just simply asked in my mind, I'm entering into what is essentially a discipleship relationship with him. Now, sure, I'm paying tuition, but I'm buying his time. I'm helping support his livelihood in the context of this university through my tuition dollars. And so is this a man that I want to be like? Is there anything that he has that I want to receive? And this, he was so generous. I still can't believe this. We spent about 4 hours together before I was even enrolled. Like, this was me still thinking, do I want to do this or not? And we had lunch together. We spent some time in his office. And I came away from that situation and I thought, yes, there are convictions that he holds. There is acumen that he holds. There's passion that he has that I want to receive. I want him to rub off on me. And so it's going to be worth spending a couple of years with this guy. And man, he totally delivered. It's just such a joy to have been a part of a program and be led by that guy. Dr. Bob Ray, Why Church History Matters, by the way, if you've never read it, InterVarsity published it. Awesome book.
Awesome. And so as you have, you know, studied through church history, I know as I studied church history, I had taken a summer and read all the, you know, atheist books I could read. And then it's probably, I think it was the next summer, I started reading a lot more church history. For me, the church history books were harder on my faith than the atheist books by far. The atheists didn't have that great of, you know, evidence against Christianity. And yet seeing some of the things that had happened in our history is like, wow, this isn't fun. You know, now there are a lot of bright spots as well. But for you, as you studied church history, were there any of those kind of cringe moments? Was there any particular moment that was like, man, this is rough?
Yeah. I mean, goodness, it doesn't take long for the church to instantly find controversy. You know, the first things we're working out as a church are how are we talking about the Godhead, the Trinitarian controversy? How are we talking about the person of Christ, the Christological controversy? And I mean, we're at each other's throats already. We're talking past each other already. I mean, I still remember it took weeks for me in like studying the Trinitarian controversy to like, you got Greek speakers and Latin speakers that are not connecting on the issue of how we talk about God and I remember like trying to sift through all these terms like homoiousios and una substantia. And essentially you've got two different groups of people that are trying to communicate the same thing, but their language means the opposite. And it just blows up from there. We're so prone to confusion. And then you add confusion to the will to want to be right all the time and the pride that goes with being right all the time. I like to say that I can't afford to be right all the time. It's way too expensive to be right all the time because it costs me my pride. I cannot handle being right all the time because it goes straight to my head. And then I experience the opposition of God. I experience the degradation of my faith and being because God opposes the proud and he gives grace to the humble. But you see it throughout the ages. I mean, it's there sometimes, you know, if I look back over moments in church history, you know, early on, we're trying to determine which bishopric, which see has preeminence, who's more in charge than is it Antioch? Is it Rome? You know, they're already at each other. And then ultimately, you know, they're having to work out, well, what happens when you disagree with Rome? Like, how do you go forward? Brutal things. I mean, I would say I'll zero in on a couple of things. I'm just kind of surfing through time, but you know, you get to, you know, 1054 and, you know, we have this, that what I think is somehow one of the most underrated events in the history of humanity, the great East-West split, the great schism. Protestants in America tend to think that the church split started with Luther when it's like, no, like we were already really good at this. You know, wind back 5 centuries and we're already having massive, massive issues to the point where, you know, you see Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy go their separate directions. I think even beyond that, if I, you know, to zero in on, obviously, as a group of people that are a part of a unity movement, these moments tend to stand out to me when you see the Reformation happen. If I were to say there's a moment of like total cringe for me of like, where my heart just grieves. You see a bunch of this stuff unfold for Luther to have convictions that I share in so many of his convictions. The reality is that Luther was not the only one who was looking at the selling of grievances, who was looking at the state of leadership in the church and saying, hey, there are some things that are seriously wrong right now that need to change. He was not the only one who thought that. And I think sometimes modern Protestants tend to think that Luther was the only hero in the room. When at the same time, I think about a guy like Desiderius Erasmus, who looks at the state of the church and says, yeah, it's like, this is messed up. And I'm going to do everything I can to help fix it. And I'm not leaving. I'm going to stay and tolerate it and fix it. And I'm grateful that God has moved through it anyway, because he's so good at being the head that he can move even through a broken body, a divided body. What an extraordinary example of headship from Jesus. It's to his glory and to his credit that he brings something a whole and eternal through a broken and disobedient body. But there is something about the spirit of a guy like Erasmus that could benefit us in this day and age. How many times do we get people who look at certain elements of a local church, for instance, and say, man, this is wrong. I'm leaving. And sometimes that's the right move. Sometimes that's the right move. I can't give some blanket advice to everybody on what's the right or wrong thing to do. But man, I think we could use more of that sort of tenacity of Erasmus to say, I don't know. There isn't another church. This is it. And I am going to my dying breath, do everything I can to help her and to benefit her and to nurture her, to correct her, to stay in the truth. Man, there's just something about that. We've got a little bit of an easy come, easy go mentality in the church today that is most of the time based on what we are happy to consume. And I think too, we opened up all these options as a result, and it has been the perfect storm of options and consumers that it's turned the church into something that is entirely different than what it had been. What it had been designed to be. You know, we think about it as a place we go to get something instead of a place we're sent from to give something. It's a shopping mall instead of a launch pad for discipleship. And so, man, I look back on that and, you know, even beyond that, Protestantism's tendency to almost completely ignore the Counter-Reformation there's something really beautiful about Catholics in the Counter-Reformation standing up and saying, whoa, 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 whoa. Like, guys, Luther made some good points. It took so much courage for that to happen. Man, more of that, please, you know?
Yeah. And then you have Protestants turning against each other, most notably in the Anabaptists, you know, who I've heard did better. Many of them did better in Muslim lands than in the lands of their fellow Protestants, where, you know, thousands of them were killed, drowned by fire. Fast forward now to, you know, the Presbyterian Church in, I believe, Ireland, you know, old light, new light controversy, burger versus anti-burger, seceder, you know, it just kept getting carved up, more and more atomized type of church. So enter the Restoration Movement. What in the Restoration Movement for you as you were studying it was a breath of you know, fresh air? What was a relief that you saw there?
I was shocked. I had no idea. I had never heard of the Restoration Movement until I was in college. I was a freshman at a Restoration Movement college, not knowing that it was a Restoration Movement college. I didn't know there was a Restoration Movement. I went to St. Luke's Christian College. Like several months into the first semester, Keith McCaslin was teaching. It was like Old Testament surveyor, history of Israel, I think. And I remember in the context of conversation, the fact that we were St. Louis Christian College and that meant something other than like, you know, Baptists are Christians and Presbyterians are Christians. And like, you mean like Christian, like there's like a kind of Christian that you're talking about? He's like, yeah, the Restoration Movement. And I was like, no, hold on a second. You should have named this place St. Louis Christian College. And then I'd have a much better understanding of what I'm getting myself into. I mean, I had been a part of a Restoration church that I didn't even know. We'd attended for almost 3 years, and I didn't even know that it was a thing. The only way I connected to the Restoration Movement was on my PSAT, my sophomore year, Catholic dad, Baptist mom, like, I'm just a Christian. I fill out this thing. It was like the closest one I could find. It said Christian church. I didn't know that that was a thing. And so then I started getting all this literature from a brotherhood that I didn't know was a brotherhood. No idea. And I remember hearing some of the brief history of our movement, the plea for unity, to hear Jesus pray, Father, may they be one as you and I are one, so that the world may know that you sent me, in John 17. I remember being so elated that, like, there were already people who thought this. And so we hear all these axioms, you know, we're Christians only, not the only Christians. I'm like, yeah, I agree. I like that a lot. And here I was, this byproduct of the movement without even knowing that there was a movement. And so when I think about some of the, this just lights my heart up for the Restoration Movement. When guys like Barton Stone and Alexander Campbell and his dad, are looking at the state of rivalry and tribalism in the church, they are trying to match that up with what Jesus prays for in John 17 and saying, these are so far from each other that we are clearly off the path. God, would you restore what you actually wanted for the church? What is so extraordinary about that is, in that context, the idea of being independent and not denominationally governed was like, you guys are the biggest fools in the world. Get out. Like, are you idiots? Like, no way. And it's so ironic because they arrive at that conclusion of local autonomy, of doing the best they can to follow biblical models of governance, of maintaining the word of God as central authority, unity based on the authority of Christ and his word, not on whatever traditions, whatever church authority has been put in place. I love that now, that in this day and age, in a day where non-denominationalism is in vogue, I'm so grateful to be a part of something that has its moorings in history, in conviction around the truth, a unity movement out of conviction, not a unity movement out of pragmatism. And we don't want anybody, it's just bad branding. You know, our focus marketing groups are telling us, yeah, the denominational name is just not good. That doesn't change anything if it's just a name. I love that this is rooted more deeply than hoping that something works. Because when I think about Jesus' prayer, Father, may they be one, as you and I are one, so that the world may know that you sent me. I think that there that's not Jesus just saying, hey, would the machine work right? It doesn't work well when the parts are not lined up. There's something profound, deeply spiritual in this that I think lines up with Jesus' abidance language in the Gospel of John. I'm going to remain in you. You're going to remain in me. When you look at all of the illustrations of the church in Scripture, think about it. Every one of these illustrations of the church in Scripture, I'm the vine, you're the branches. I'm the head, you're the body. I'm the husband, you're the wife. I'm the sheep, you're the shepherd. All of these illustrations denote connection. All of them. That's a common denominator in all of these illustrations. And when there's disconnection, things break and they don't work. And so here's Jesus. Apart from me, you can do nothing. If you remain in me, I'll remain in you. You'll bear much fruit. Like, I love that there are people that recognize that before it was popular to do it. Man, what I like that conviction. I share in that conviction. I benefit from their conviction.
As a lead pastor, you know, what are some of the Restoration Movement principles that you're aware of as you lead that kind of form your, you know, how you lead the church?
Yeah, I think there's some healthy things in governance that are really important. So one of the things that I'm actually really excited to tell people we have that a thing that's like, if you're new around here, we do it once a month. This is a great way to get to know the church. This is a great way to get known, take some next steps, how to get involved and add momentum to the mission. One of the things I always tell them, we bring out some distinctives for our church. And so we talk a little bit about communion. We talk about baptism and we talk about the way this church is led. And the assumption sometimes is that people think that, well, I'm the pastor, so I'm in charge. I have I have this monarchical leadership when the reality is, you know, we're plurality-based eldership. Every elder submitted to the eldership. And I am like, it brings my heart some joy to know that I have brothers that we share success together. And we share failure together. We have one yes, and we have one no. And that is forcing us to raise up people to be responsible for the mission in a local context. There isn't somebody that is living 7 or 8 hours away that has no idea who we are really. We are forced to take responsibility. And what I love about that is that people rise to the occasion. They're filled with faith, and they move forward. They do what God calls them to do, and we're seeing that happen. I mean, we got an accountant, a former engineer, you know, farmer, like that are in the kitchen when it comes to leading and asking God to move us forward as a church. What a beautiful thing.
It's awesome. You know, looking at the Restoration Movement history, what are some things that, you know, you wish you could rewrite about our history? And, you know, what could thoughtful Restoration Movement leaders perhaps have done to you know, make those changes, prevent those, you know, things from happening?
I mean, of course, some of the obvious stuff is like, oh, could we have done better in arguments about instruments? Could we have done better about arguments about how we're going to organize support for missions with the whole Disciples of Christ thing? Of course, with that, you end up lacing those things with culture and politics that just convolutes the whole issue. It's because everybody's got their sort of version of, I love to hear people try to talk about our movement as like a spectrum of a political ideology and who's left, who's right, who's middle in terms of progression and conservatism. And even that, like I just had a conversation with a Church of Christ guy a couple of weeks ago who's saying like, well, we're not as conservative as you make us out to be. And so, which was very interesting. And so all of that just makes this big mess. And so, of course, I could see that. But I would say maybe more usefully for our discussion, I have found it, to say it mildly, perplexing that a movement that is intended to be a unity movement can go about it in such a sectarian way sometimes. And I think we really wrestle sometimes with, you know, with our doctrine. I think about ministries I've been involved in where there are multiple churches trying to pour into the same stream and help each other. And times where Christian churches have said, oh, no, we can't participate because we have different ideas on certain theologies. And what's interesting is like I would give you a perfect example. There was a ministry that was focused toward high schoolers, multiple churches pouring into that. And the concern was that several of the other churches were Baptist churches. And some of the Baptist churches felt the same way as some of the Christian churches about this. I remember one of the stories was that one of the Baptist churches said, we can't participate in this ministry because it's not Baptist. And another fellow Baptist church said to him, well, like, why does that matter this much? And he said, well, people died for the Baptist movement and for the Baptist faith. And I remember my brother tells me the story. He said, and I looked at this guy and I said, then they died for the wrong thing. And so I say that, and I think some of the Christian church folks are like, yes, that's right. You know, you guys are doofuses. And then we look at it and say, oh, they don't share a theology around baptism, so we better not participate. And you know what we did when we did that? We guaranteed that we would not bear any fruit from that ministry. And I remember saying to these guys, we've got students who are in this ministry. And if somebody from the Baptist church leads somebody to Jesus in that ministry, where do you think they're going to go to church? You can go to the Baptist church. It makes total sense. Okay, what if one of our kids leads somebody to Jesus in that ministry? Where do you think they're going to go to church? They're going to come to our church. So if you choose to say, no more, we can't be involved, then we guarantee that we will see no fruit and everyone else is going to reap the harvest without us in this ministry. I think that's something for me that I in some ways it could cause me to grieve, like this denial of the mission to maintain what is doctrinal purity. And I think sometimes we tend to overinflate ourselves with being right about everything in a posture that says I'm right about all of this and nobody else needs to talk to me. In fact, I'll just kind of do my own thing over here. There's not a lot of fruit there.
I've been talking with Dr. Rick Cherock about the restoration movement. One of the things he said that was just super helpful was that, you know, some of us in the restoration movement tended to emphasize unity over truth. Others tended to emphasize truth over unity. And both sides eventually, you know, forgot the whole point of it all. And that is for the sake of the gospel. We can keep that front and center. I think that'll help us get that balance of unity based in truth. I think that can help.
Because unity is not the goal, even according to Jesus. It's not the end. Hey, Father, may they be one as you and I are one, which is a profound level of unity. I can't even articulate that level of unity that Jesus and his Father share. May they be one as you and I are one, so that the world may know that you sent me.
Yeah.
The implication of this is mission. I had a Presbyterian mentor when I was in high school. He was such an interesting guy. He was Presbyterian. He was a Presbyterian pastor, but he was like a closet charismatic. And he was just like the funniest mix of stuff. He was very involved in the underground church in China. This guy was like so interesting, impossible to box in. And so I remember him telling me once, as I had just gotten a few tastes of the restoration movement. And I said, man, we got to get unified. You know, of course, I'd heard people say, man, people just believe what the Bible says. That'd be easy, right? And I was like, of course, if people would agree with me about what the Bible says, then it would be easy. Well, of course, it would be easy. It really wouldn't be unity. It would be uniformity. If we can get everybody to say the same thing, that doesn't mean we're unified. It's deeper than that. It's more significant than that. And I remember him saying, well, what if we based our unity? What if we started in mission? What if we started in mission? Which of course is founded in truth, is commanded by Jesus. I mean, this guy's starting, he's seeing this stuff in the early 2000s when barely anybody's talking about discipleship. And he brings me to Matthew 28 and says, I want to say yes to this. Do you want to say yes to this? I was like, well, if Jesus is making a command to it, yeah, I'm on board, even though I have no clue, you know? And I remember, and that doesn't solve all the problems, but man, we got a lot farther when we started with, I'm going to be obedient to Jesus, not just I'm going to have polished perfection in my doctrine.
So we're going to be going to the gathering, the Renew gathering in Indianapolis. It'll be April 29th and 30th. So yeah, tell us, right? What are you talking about?
Yeah. So the picture is turning on every spigot that is available to us for discipleship. And so I'm leading in what some of our DMM guys, some of our disciple making movement guys would say is a legacy church. And I think sometimes when you get a vehicle that is not living up to its potential and you want to renovate it, you want it to be better, you know, sometimes you got to take the whole thing apart, right? You take a frame off restoration and man, I'm going to like get down to the very last bolt and everything is going to be fixed. The results are awesome when you get there. It takes a long time, takes a lot of resources. In some situations when it comes to renovating the church in our obedience to the command of Jesus, sometimes that's the right answer. I will say I have perceived at times though, where some of my brothers in those circles are not necessarily as interested in like meticulously taking apart the car as they are lighting a stick of dynamite and putting it in the gas tank.
That's quicker.
Blow it up. And then we will pick the parts up from the 3-acre spread of the explosion. Honestly, sometimes that might be the right thing to do. I can't make that discernment for anybody else's situation and anybody else's circumstance. What I can say is that where I live, where I am, there is much more immediate potential for moving the mission forward than to take a wrecking ball to this. And so in my mind, I look at a group of people that are, we have a culture that loves the truth. The Thessalonians were saved by their love of the truth, according to Paul, right? That there's something significant about loving the truth. That is deep in the culture of this church. We have a group of people that have been for a long time urged to participate in the mission and in varying degrees of significance. You know, I'm not saying we've been perfect about getting people on mission. Sometimes we've been slow to share significant responsibility. But at the minimum, we have more people here that serve than are in small groups. So there's something. There's something interesting about that because from a statistical standpoint, when you look at like big mile markers for growing in faith, over the last 20 years, people who've served have literally grown faster than people who are in small groups. And so where we've put all of our energy and discipleship in one program and model, what would happen if we hijacked everything for the purpose of discipleship? And so that's what we'll be talking about. Everything we do is an occasion for discipleship. How do you take existing ministry structures and repurpose and renovate them for the mission for significant advancement of the mission of the kingdom through the stuff that's already here.
Man, super helpful. Thanks, Jason. Appreciate it.
Glad to, man. Very glad to.
Thank you for listening to this episode on the podcast. If you want to hear more from Daniel and Jason, consider coming to the renew.org 2024 Courageous Renewal Gathering. It's going to be a great time. Daniel McCoy has a breakout as well as Jason, and they're both talking about various topics. Great content, great stuff, and I hope to see you guys there. Now, coming up next week, we got a brand new series talking about the disciples' mind. So stay tuned for more details.